You're listening to CBC Radio 2, 94.1 in Toronto, 103.9 in Peterborough.
I'm Philly Markowitz, and here's a look at some of the programming that you'll hear over the next few hours. First up, it's On Stage with host Eric Friesen, and this week it's Stuart McLean's Canada, featuring, of course, Stuart McLean, also Cameron Wilson and Joe Trio. And 2 hours from now, you'll hear Say It with Music. And this week, Richard Azunian toasts the nightlife. Evenings are getting longer, so I guess it's time to think about all the wonderful musical comedies and comedy songs about what happens after the sun goes down. Songs like While the City Sleeps, But Alive, and I Want to Be Seen with You are going to be featured this afternoon. I'll be back 3 hours from now with Roots and Wings, and I'm going to bring you some examples of new directions for flamenco, including flamenco guitar with Egyptian percussion and strings, and flamenco with a jazz ensemble, and a great result of pairing up Inuit throat singing with thumb piano and accordion.
Here is the CBC News. I'm Bill Bird. In British Columbia, more than 700 people are out of their homes as a result of flooding. The towns of Squamish and Pemberton remain under a state of emergency. And Whistler and Pemberton remain cut off from the rest of the province due to highway closures and a bridge washout. The flooding has been caused by 3 days of record rainfall. More than 200 millimeters have fallen so far. Robert Zimmerman reports.
In Pemberton, the highways remain closed in and out of the village, and more than 100 people have been forced to leave their homes. Mayor Eleanor Warner says the highway has been cut off for more than a day, and some grocery stores have already run out of supplies.
So we still remain isolated. We're trying to get food in, and hopefully they will arrange a helicopter to bring in milk and stuff this afternoon. And we're activating excavators, all that kind of thing, emergency equipment, and coping as best we can.
And in Squamish, another 300 people remain evacuated from their homes. Mayor Ian Sutherland says crews continue checking water levels in the area.
This morning we're continuing to monitor the dike system and the level of the Daisy Lake Dam. We have the crews out checking all the roads and property damage along the way. And the big thing right now is just monitoring all the situations and then reacting as needed.
It looks like this situation may not get better anytime soon. Forecasters say the rain should let up in the area today, but they're expecting heavy rain to be back tomorrow. Robert Zimmerman, CBC News, Vancouver.
Late word from the Middle East, 3 Israelis have been killed in a shooting attack in the West Bank. Further details are not yet available. Earlier in the day, in the West Bank city of Jenin, troops raided the offices of the militant group Islamic Jihad. 2 men were arrested. Computers and documents were confiscated. Meantime, Israeli troops have pulled out of a refugee camp along the Gaza-Egypt border. During the 4-day operation, witnesses say 4 militants and 4 bystanders were killed. 15 homes were demolished. Admirers across India are celebrating Mother Teresa's beatification by Pope John Paul II in Rome today. Rallies, prayers, and feasts were held in honor of the nun who served the poor in India and beyond. Hundreds of people turned out for a special morning service at her home. It's now known as Mother House and serves as the global headquarters of the Missionaries of Charity, the order she founded in 1949. In the capital, New Delhi, celebratory prayers were held in 51 churches. It's looking more and more like Canadians will go to the polls in early 2004. Prime Minister to-be Paul Martin says an election is likely in the spring. He says it's normal for a new prime minister to go to the people for a mandate. The government's current mandate doesn't run out for another 25 months. 2 U.S. soldiers have been killed in the latest violence in Iraq. Their convoy was ambushed near the town of Kirkuk. Elsewhere, a U.S. military vehicle exploded when a convoy was attacked in the central town of Fallujah. The BBC's Jill McGivern reports from Baghdad.
The U.S. forces were on patrol late last night near Kirkuk when they came under attack from rocket-propelled grenades and small arms fire. 2 soldiers were killed and 1 wounded. In a separate incident this morning, a U.S. military convoy, apparently carrying weapons and ammunition, was attacked after it had broken down in Fallujah, west of Baghdad. The resulting explosion sent debris flying and caused large clouds of black smoke, but there were no casualties. These latest attacks serve as a reminder of the daily opposition coalition troops continue to face, most of it focused in Baghdad and the so-called Sunni Triangle, northwest of the capital. The number of attacks on troops nationwide in the last 24 hours was 15, lower than the daily average of about 20. But the steadily rising number of dead is causing increasing concern, both in Washington and here amongst troops, many of whom are now thought to have low morale.
Jill McGivern reporting. Some politicians and advocates for the poor call a proposal by Alberta's minister responsible for housing outrageous. The minister suggests the province may start charging homeless people on welfare to stay in shelters. Out of the plan, some of the money would be returned once the person finds a permanent place to live. That is CBC Radio News. I'm Bill Bird.
And now your updated weather forecast as issued by Environment Canada for Toronto, Hamilton, Peterborough, and the Kawarthas. Today, a mix of sun and cloud, a slight gusting wind from the north at 20 kilometers per hour, a high near 11. Tonight, cloudy skies and a low near zero. And for tomorrow, a mix of sun and cloud, slight gusting winds continuing and a high near 16 degrees.
You are listening to CBC Radio 2.
The CBC Radio Orchestra. Based in Vancouver, it's the last radio orchestra in North America. And this season, it's 65 years old. Some memories.
From Vancouver, the CBC brings you the last program in the current series, Serenade, under the direction of John Avison. This evening, the assisting artist of the orchestra, the West Coast pianist Norma Abernethy, will be heard in the Mendelssohn Concerto in G minor.
Come now to our performance of The Dream of Gerontius, with Maureen Forrester, contralto, Richard Lewis, tenor, John Dunbar, baritone, and the CBC Orchestra and Vancouver Bach Choir, conducted by John Avison. Part 1, in which Gerontius...
Today's concert by the CBC Vancouver Chamber Orchestra includes works by Tartini, Karl Birger Blomdahl, and Mozart. The orchestra is under the direction of its regular conductor, John Avison, and our soloist is the Vancouver pianist, Phyllis Taylor. The orchestra is heard first in the concerto...
We present now a concert by the CBC Vancouver Chamber Orchestra, under the direction of John Avison. On today's program, we will hear works by Mio, Schubert, and a special dedication to the orchestra and its conductor by Percy Young. To begin today's program, we will hear...
Conductor John Elliott Gardner leads the CBC Vancouver Orchestra today in music by Schubert, Richard Strauss, and Hector Berlioz. Guest soloists on the program are horn player Martin Hackelman and mezzo-soprano Delia Wallace.
Hello, and welcome back to the Take 5 Concert. I'm Shelley Soames. Today, Alvaro Pieri will be along to play guitar concertos by Ponce and Villa-Lobos, and we'll also hear Spanish orchestral music with Mario Bernardi and the CBC Radio Orchestra.
And now it's my turn. I've introduced the CBC Radio Orchestra many times, and it's my pleasure to do it again this year, this 65th season. Hello again. I'm Eric Friesen. And welcome to On Stage and another concert made in Canada. Later I'll have some more storytelling by veteran CBC Radio Orchestra musicians. But first the concert. There's something new, and there are some great Canadian classics as well, like John Weinzweig's The Red Ear of Corn and Godfrey Rideout's Frivolité Canadienne. And for the new, we have an Upper Canada Fiddle Suite by John Burge. And to begin, something fun, a lot of fun. It's called The History of Canada, a lighthearted look at our country's history, co-written by our own Stuart MacLean and composer Cameron Wilson of Vancouver's Joe Trio. Every once in a while, a work for narrator and orchestra comes along that becomes a classic of its kind. Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf, Garrison Keillor's Young Lutheran's Guide to the Orchestra. Now, here's a brand new Canadian entry. Stuart McLean narrates the history of Canada with the help of a lot of regional humor and some slightly twisted historical fact. Cam Wilson's musical score draws upon familiar Canadian themes, cartoon music, P.D.Q. Bach, you'll hear Spike Jones and Celine Dion. The History of Canada, co-written by Stuart McLean and Cameron Wilson. Mario Bernardi conducts the CBC Radio Orchestra with Stuart McLean and Joe Trio. Joe Trio is Cameron Wilson violin, cellist Laura McPheeters, and pianist Alan Stiles. The History of Canada begins with an overture.
We begin our story in the foggy days of prehistory, when the land was wild, when forests of moss-dripped trees covered the continent, when dinosaurs roamed through the badlands of Saskatchewan. This is prehistoric Canada, a period which covers everything before the arrival of Celine Dion. Canada, B.C. Before Celine. It was lush, and it was dark, and it was wild. The only intruders were the giant glaciers which would periodically crawl out of the Arctic and cover the land. The ice advanced as far south as Sudbury. At Sudbury, the ice returned and went back to the Arctic for more rocks. The glaciers advanced and receded like the tides for years, making Canada one of the first countries with automatic defrosting. As they crept out of the Arctic, these huge flux of ice ground down everything in their path, driving all the inhabitants south. Today, this feature of Canadian life is provided by Revenue Canada. The first white explorer to reach the New World came from a world of ice, Eric the Red. Other Scandinavians tried to sail across the Atlantic, but they failed. Eric the Red was a Norse of a different color. Young students sometimes ask how it was that Eric the Red landed in Canada. With a name like that, he had a fat chance of landing in the United States. Thanks to the description that Eric took home, nobody else tried to discover Canada for several hundred years. Eventually, the Europeans did return to the New World. Intrigued by colorful travel brochures and lured by a favorable rate of exchange, they forsook the beaches of the Mediterranean and arrived by the boatload. They came during the summer for the annual fishing festivals held off the east coast of Newfoundland. Of course, they didn't know they were in Newfoundland. They thought they were in Bombay. When they realized where they were, the cruise business dried up. The fishermen were replaced by explorers who sailed west looking for the east. They were like dogs chasing their tails. What they discovered was a vast continent already settled by the great Indian nations. The further west they went, the more of the great Neolithic tribes they met. The Huron, the Algonquin, the Iroquois, and the Socreds. The first French explorer to sail up the St. Lawrence was Jacques Cartier, later immortalized in the Quebec national anthem, Frère Jacques. Cartier ascended the St. Lawrence as far as the Indian village of Hochelaga. There he stood on the summit of Mount Royal and was told stories of a rich territory just up the river where treasures were abundant for the taking. This proved to be a lie. Ottawa wouldn't be founded for years. Other famous French explorers were the cartographer Samuel de Champlain, the father of New France, who in the summer of 1605 helped build the Habitation at Port Royal. Champlain organized the Ordre de Bon Temps, the first social club in North America, known in English as Hockey Night in Canada. Many of the explorers who opened up the new territories went on to open car dealerships. There was LaSalle, DeSoto, and Cadillac. Ville-Marie, now known as Montreal, was founded by Paul de Chamédy de Maisonneuve, or Queen Elizabeth, as he's known in English. Maisonneuve's settlement immediately drew the fear and hatred of the Iroquois, the Algonquin, and of Toronto, which was just about to be discovered. These early voyageurs, or voyageurs as they were known in English, found the New World rich in fish and wood and furs. They presented themselves to the Indians as emissaries of foreign kings, but the natives saw them for what they were, pale and sickly men who had no skills to live off the land. They couldn't even survive a winter without help. Not only that, these know-nothings, as they were known in French, were prepared to trade woven fabrics and metal goods that were unavailable locally at any price. Trade them for the skins of a few animals that could be found in abundance by anyone who wanted them. They actually preferred used furs because they were softer. It was as if aliens had arrived from outer space, offering unimagined technological delights in exchange for a few old clothes. Eventually, the French fur traders paddling upriver met English fur traders paddling downriver. The result was that the French fur... The result was that the French were... The result was that the French... Enough! The result was that the French began a campaign of pillaging British forts. Where there was no fort for the French to pillage, the British built one. This went on for more years than anyone cares to remember, owing to the long distances the armies had to march to meet defeat. Until finally the British and the French agreed to meet on the Plains of Abraham to decide once and for all who owned the continent. The British troops were led by General James Wolfe, who had been carefully trained in the British military art of losing every battle but the last one. The French were led by Lieutenant General Louis-Joseph the Marquis de Montcalm, or as he was known in English, Céline Dion. After midnight on September the 13th, the British troops floated past the Citadel of Quebec on rubber inner tubes, fooling a sentinel who assumed that they were just white water rafting. After much argument, they had agreed to rendezvous in a rocky cove, a cove they chose because it coincidentally bore the same name as General Wolfe. When Montcalm awoke the next morning and saw the British troops doing their morning stretches on the Plains of Abraham, he decided upon the only course of action that would ensure his defeat. He left the safety of the fort to fight. During the battle, Montcalm was shot. After conferring with his staff, he decided the wisest course of action was to die. When he was told that he had won the battle and would be expected to winter over in Canada, Wolfe immediately decided to die himself. After the defeat of the French, whenever that was, the 13 British colonies to the south realized that without France to worry about, they no longer needed Britain's protection. Meanwhile, to the south, a group of prominent colonists signed the Declaration of Independence. When someone noticed Canada was closer than Mother England and the going drier underfoot, the colonial army attacked unfairly, hitting below the border wherever possible. The British were obliged to advance backwards until the fleet arrived. When the fleet did arrive, Governor Carleton was able to chase the Americans back across the border. Carleton, however, was unimpressed with the lackadaisical support he received from British North Americans. So after the war, he went home to England in a huff, which was the favorite means of transportation of British governors at the time. According to the Treaty of Paris, both sides in the war agreed a border would be drawn between the two countries so that no matter where a train or bus crossed it, immigration officers would be able to wake passengers up in the middle of the night. After the Americans had won their revolution, those people in the colonies who had bet on George III had a choice of being shot or moved to the Canadian Maritimes. Some of the braver families chose the Maritimes and became known as the Loyalists. What with the French and the English, the Indians and the Loyalists, things became very confusing along the banks of the St. Lawrence. For this reason, the British government sent Carleton back to Canada, having taken the precaution of changing his name to Lord Dorchester. Under Lord Dorchester, Canada was divided into two parts, Lower Canada and Upper Canada. This was the beginning of Canadian politics. When he realized what he had started, Lord Dorchester huffed home to England one more time. To forestall any more appointments to Canada, he died. The War of 1812 began when the Americans noticed on the evening news that Britain was busy fighting Napoleon. The European war gave the Americans an idea. Canada's only successful military strategy seemed to be the arrival of the British fleet. It was obvious. Britain's preoccupation with Napoleon made it a good time to liberate Canada again. A few Canadians and Indians under General Brock chose to fight for continued tyranny. This ragtag bunch, who were known as the Brockbusters, went on after the war to establish a successful chain of video stores. Before the Americans could rally, the War of 1812 had been held over to 1813. For the Americans, 1813 was one of the worst years of the War of 1812, though not as bad as 1814, which is when they tried to surprise the Canadians at the beaver dams. Laura Secord, who knew the beavers personally, swam 20 miles upstream and warned the Canadian forces. Secord went on to form a chain of video stores which failed because she stuck to the beta format. The war was ended with the signing of the Treaty of Paris, and at this point of Canadian history, everything stopped for the opening of the West. The coastal people of the Northwest were like no others in North America. They lived in a world of mountains and rivers, islands and inlets, colossal cedars and lush rainforests. In the summer, fat salmon swam up the mountain rivers in such numbers that early explorers like James Cook and George Vancouver reported that they could walk across the rivers on the salmon's backs. Of course, after they'd spent a few weeks on the West Coast, they also reported they could fly, listen to music for hours without moving, and eat a family-sized bag of Doritos in one sitting. Meanwhile, the interior of the young country was being mapped by Scotsmen working for the Hudson Bay Company. One of the Scots was Alexander Mackenzie, who was the first European to reach the Pacific by land. Another was Simon Fraser, who discovered a large river that he thought was the Columbia, but by coincidence, turned out to be the Fraser. The western plains that these men were traveling across offered spectacular vistas of blue skies and prairie grasses waving in the wind. And of course, great herds of bison. Large, shaggy creatures with shoulder humps and manes of hair around their head and neck. The Europeans were so taken by the buffalo that they immediately set about to exterminate them, killing over 50 million during the 1800s, often by driving entire herds over cliffs known as buffalo jumps. When there were no more buffalo left to slaughter, the Hudson's Bay Company didn't know what to do with their Saturday afternoons. They missed the bellowing herds kicking and plunging into carnage, but they were soon able to recapture the excitement for their store customers. Since that time, whenever that was, the buffalo hunt has largely been replaced by bay days. It was at this time that another creature with a shoulder hump and a shaggy mane of hair arose out of the Canadian wilderness. He was soon identified as Sir John A. Macdonald. Macdonald was a politician of great natural charm, which was especially strong when he exhaled. It was Sir John who led the push towards a confederation of the Canadian and Maritime provinces. To celebrate the union of British North America, the Fathers of Confederation had their picture taken. The date of this historic occasion was July the 1st, 1867, which is the only date in Canadian history. Except for the end of the War of 1812, which was 1814. Having become more charming than ever, Macdonald went to London and helped the Queen choose a name for the newborn country, settling on Canada because that's what it was already called. They also chose the motto, Amare Usque Amare, which roughly translated means a little water with the whiskey, please. In the next election, the Canadian population went over to the Mackenzies. Alexander Mackenzie introduced a temperance act, and that made Macdonald so mad he joined up with a new party called Canada Thirst, and he was poured back into office. The railway was finished at last. And on a date that went down in Canadian history and never came up again, the last spike was driven at Craigellachie, British Columbia. Saskatchewan, which hadn't had its rebellion yet, was resentful and soon broke out in hostilities. The Métis sent to the United States for Louis Riel, who had been hanged several years previously. But due to a strict training program and plenty of road work, Riel was making a dramatic comeback. After being hanged, Riel had been elected to Parliament, but was disqualified on the grounds that being deceased, he was only eligible for the Senate. This left Riel bitter toward the government, and he seized the opportunity to lead a rebel force. He was, however, caught again and hanged at Regina. This time it took, and he never ran for public office again. A few years later, Sir John A. Macdonald died, drawing favorable notices from all parts of the empire. The conservatives fell into the hands of men who lacked his vision and couldn't hold their charm. Canada thus went liberal under Sir Wilfrid Laurier, owner of the popular Ottawa Chateau. Canada has been more or less liberal ever since, except for 6 years under John Diefenbaker, 6 minutes under Joe Clark, and 6 centuries under Brian Mulroney. Today, 3 years into the new century, the country remains strong.
That was a Canadian fiddle medley based on fiddle tunes from all over Canada, written by Cameron Wilson of Joe Trio and performed by the trio. This is On Stage from the Chan Centre Vancouver here on CBC Radio 1 and Radio 2. The CBC Radio Orchestra is 65 years old this season, and here at On Stage World Headquarters, we're celebrating with a concert of Canadian music. Next, a Canadian classic. It's John Weinzweig's Barn Dance, which draws on First Nations and French-Canadian folk music. Barn Dance comes from his 1949 ballet called The Red Ear of Corn. Mario Bernardi leads the CBC Radio Orchestra.
Thank you.
Barn Dance from the ballet The Red Ear of Corn by John Weinzweig. The dance band was the CBC Radio Orchestra, Mario Bernardi conducting. This is On Stage. It's a concert made in Canada. It's a made in Canada celebration of the 65th anniversary of this CBC Radio Orchestra. We heard a Canadian fiddle suite earlier, played by Joe Trio. Here's another piece in the same theme for string orchestra this time by Kingston, Ontario composer John Burge. It's a piece called Upper Canada Fiddle Suite. It's in three movements, reel, waltz, and jig. The fiddlers here are all from the CBC Radio Orchestra.
Thank you.
Suite by John Burge. You heard the strings of the CBC Radio Orchestra, Mario Bernardi conducting. This is On Stage. Today we're celebrating the 65th anniversary of this CBC Radio Orchestra on both of our radio networks. The last piece from the concert is Godfrey Rideout's Frivolité, celebrating the 65th anniversary of this CBC Radio Orchestra on both of our radio networks. The last piece from the concert is Godfrey Rideout's Frivolité Canadienne, based on themes from the turn-of-the-century Canadian composer Joseph Vézina. There are three movements to this piece. Opens with a march, then a nocturne, and a grand concert waltz. Thank you. Volonté Canadien by Godfrey Rideout, recreating the charming world of French-Canadian operetta, again played by the CBC Radio Orchestra, Mario Bernardi conducting. And that ends this concert of Canadian music made in Canada, celebrating the 65th anniversary of our orchestra. The concert was produced by Denise Ball with recording engineer Don Harder, both of CBC Vancouver. Now, as I promised earlier, I have some reminiscences of the of those early days of the CBC Radio Orchestra, or the CBC Vancouver Orchestra, as it used to be called. John Avison was the orchestra's first conductor. He led it from its very first rehearsal in 1938 until he retired in 1980. Musicians today remember him with fondness and respect. Former principal bassoon player George Zuckerman and principal cellist Ian Hampton look back to the Avison days.
John Avison was an astonishingly astute musician and a superb pianist. He could sight read amazingly. He had the ability to read scores. He had a great deal of savvy. 1950 was a time when there were very few trained professional musicians living and working in the city of Vancouver. And he was one of the first, and towards him gravitated other players who could share his vision, and his vision was of playing 104 Haydn symphonies and thousands of contemporary Canadian works. No orchestra that I know anywhere, Canada certainly, played so many contemporary works on such a regular basis. And the trouble with John was he wasn't a very great conductor when it came to contemporary repertoire. He had real difficulties, but he loved it so much and he was so determined to make it go. So yes, every now and then he'd give us a military command, do that, it's got to be done, and by God, it worked sometimes.
But the first time I ever played with the radio orchestra with John Avison, back in 1967, whatever, as ever with frequently new scores, you had to get the bugs out, so let's say three quarters of the recording time was spent getting the bugs out and recording the Canadian piece. And I remember being sort of rather anxious, never having experienced this before, and thinking, well, you know, lunchtime's come and we still haven't quite finished the Canadian piece, and it dragged on into the afternoon, and this session was supposed to finish at 4:30, and think, good Lord, I mean, we've still got a Haydn symphony to do. I'm getting really antsy about this, and Jack Avison was going on and unfussed, and I think at about 4:05 we began recording the Haydn symphony, and it went like a breeze. We just recorded all four movements. I thought, thank goodness, I mean, it's 4:25, and we've done it. And then John Avison says, well, now we have to record the SIG tune, because in those days, I think the signature tune was recorded live.
Every time.
That was Barber's Adagio. So at 25 past four, he started to record Barber's Adagio. But it was like that, and I remember coming away from that with just a huge respect for John Avison and the musicians.
George Zuckerman and Ian Hampton remembering the Avison days. John Avison and the orchestra churned out the music back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Most of the CBC Radio Orchestra's performances were broadcast live to air. And, of course, live to air, anything could happen. Here again is George, and then former radio producer Karen Wilson joins him, recalling one live broadcast.
The fact about John Avison, yes, he had a military background, but he was an astonishingly astute musician and a superb pianist. He could sight-read amazingly. Well, think about it, filling a 30-minute broadcast once a week for maybe 50 weeks out of 52, later on a 45-minute, then a one-hour show.
And you were going live for a long time.
It was live. You weren't allowed to record in those days.
And the rehearsal time was limited, so it meant that the musicians had to be incredibly quick about... You know, you get a chance to play through it, and then you were actually live all of Canada.
We became very good sight readers.
Yes.
We had to. But it was such an amazing opportunity to sample all of this contemporary work, some good, some bad.
Well, I've heard this story that, and I'm not sure if it's actually true, but that during one live-to-air program he was conducting, and it was coming up close to the top of the clock, but in the studio there was this great big revolving fan, and he was conducting, and the edge of his finger hit the fan and sliced off a hunk of his finger, and he just kept conducting, blood flowing.
Well, this happened
in
Studio A in the side of the Hotel Vancouver, and it was a drama show, and he had written and composed the cues, little stinger cues, and very cleverly to support the activity of the CBC Vancouver Orchestra, he would write these theater cues for different instruments every week, so that we would have different players getting the little bit of extra revenue and income. And these were very prestigious jobs. They paid all of $17. And he was there, and it was done live to air, and I remember Peter Garvey was the producer, and he was up in the booth, which was way over the up high, and you couldn't stop. The play was going on, the drama was continuing, and John stuck his hand in his fan. Smythe Humphreys ripped his shirt off, tore a tourniquet around the finger, and he got paler and paler as he played the concert. But we survived because it had to go. And can't scuttle a whole national broadcast just because somebody's chopped a piece of a finger off.
Former CBC Radio Orchestra bassoonist George Zuckerman and former orchestra producer Karen Wilson. As George mentioned, John Avison's background was military, and during the 60s and 70s, the orchestra often toured to smaller communities in BC. On one trip, George Zuckerman recalls how Avison's military background came in handy.
I got a bizarre. We're in Vancouver, and we're supposed to fly to Ucluelet on the far side of Vancouver Island, and the regular commercial plane is cancelled. And John Avison, he was a military man. He had connections with his regiment, and I don't know how he did it, but he called somebody, and within 20 minutes, an old bucket-seated DC-3 pulled up at the terminal, and we clambered on board this plane, which was normally used for parachute jumping, and we flew to Ucluelet with two smartly uniformed military officers who saluted John deferentially, and as we got off the plane, the pilot saluted smartly and said, Colonel Avison, we will see you tomorrow morning. We're going home to our family in Comox. They took off into the fog and rain, and of course the plane could not land again the next morning. And there we are sitting in Ucluelet, which is in those days of the other end of the world's worst road. It's been paved since. It's a great road now. Highway 4. And we waited and wondered how on earth we're going to get out. No plane could get in. The ceiling was so low. There was obviously no way. The only way we could get out was by vehicles. And we finally hustled around the little town and found six or seven cars, and we drove in a convoy over this incredibly bad road. At one point, we had to stop and build a bridge ourselves, if I remember correctly, and finally got into, come out of the other side of Port Alberni, and we had to go up to Port Hardy for our concert that evening. And meantime, there were no cell phones in these days, but I'd luckily been able to find a telephone and organized a charter aircraft that was picking us up on the water at Alberni, flew us up to Port Hardy. We got into the hall exactly 5 minutes before the concert was supposed to begin. 300 or 400 people sitting there waiting. We just walked on stage, played, and a memorable concert. So a disaster was turned into an occasion.
Music by Bach, and another great story told by the former principal bassoonist of the CBC Radio Orchestra, George Zukerman. This is On Stage on CBC Radio 1 and 2. We're celebrating the 65th season of the last remaining radio orchestra in North America, and listening to stories by George Zukerman and Ian Hampton. George was not only the bassoonist of the orchestra, he was also the mastermind behind the tours that took the orchestra to the far north. Here's Ian Hampton to talk about one of those trips.
The only problem was when you were touring the north that the northerners don't really have the same idea of time as we do. But I remember coming down on an it wasn't an airstrip, it was just a flat space, and George getting out of the plane and sort of pacing up and down the tundra there, wondering where the truck was to greet us.
They came with about 8 bombardiers,
yes.
Large snowmobiles, and I remember Angelina Avison shaking her head wistfully after him, saying that the driver of our bombardier was the Stirling Moss of the Arctic. He took us across these huge ripples of ice, and we got into town. Actually, there was a bleak faces on the committee when we arrived there. Turned out the hotel had burnt down the night before. So they put us around into the various houses, and John went to the home of the Catholic priest, and I think I went to the high school principal. Ian, I don't remember where you were shuttled off, the social worker. But Ron Milne, I remember, stayed in the local jail.
Yes,
that was the only place that was available.
And somebody got married, was it, when we were
there? That was in Newvik. We arrived, and the committee said, "We're sorry, you can't do the concert." It's already May, so it was light until 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, why can't we do the concert? You can't do the concert because our favorite nurse is getting married to the technician of the CBC. Big event, and everybody in town is going. So I said, when is the wedding taking place? 8:30. When it'll be through with everything and the reception, 11 o'clock? Fine, we'll begin the concert at 11:30. And Jerry Summers, who was with us on clarinet, and Judy Fraser went off in a corner and quickly wrote out an arrangement of Here Comes the Bride for full symphony orchestra, a full symphony being 32 players. And we asked the groom if he would object to live music at the ceremony. He said, why should I object? And we turned up behind a curtain, and John took the cue sort of on the side and started when the bridegroom came in. And of course the tears were utterly genuine, because it was a remarkable, moving moment. And that was what we could do. We played, and then after the ceremony and the reception, we played the concert at 11:30 at night. The second occasion is quite a contrast. It takes me to Tuktoyaktuk, and a school concert in Tuktoyaktuk, attended by nearly 350 men, women, children, cats, dogs, chickens. The whole community turned out. In fact, we arrived there, there was not a soul present except a janitor who was sweeping the school. And we thought maybe we'd come on the wrong day. And he said, oh no, they're out on the ice. And sure enough, you looked out on the ice and there are people fishing through holes 30 and 40 meters away out on the ice. There's nobody in town because it's fishing season. We got Cam Trousdale to clamber up on the roof in the freezing cold. He became the first fiddler on the roof in Tuktoyaktuk. And he played... Now, believe me, that was not a vibrato from emotion. That was a vibrato from cold. He played it beautifully. And sound travels amplified across the ice. And all of a sudden, people turned and began moving towards the hall. They realized that the event that they'd obviously known about was going to happen. And within 20 minutes, we had 350 people. I don't remember what we played, so it's not a question of repertoire. It was just the fact that we communicated with them through music. And John Avison was the medium that made it possible for us to do it.
In 1980, John Avison retired after 42 years conducting the CBC Radio Orchestra. The next conductor was the early music specialist John Elliott Gardner, and Gardner changed everything. Here's principal oboe player Roger Cole, and again we'll hear from producer Karen Wilson and cellist Ian Hampton. They're here to talk about the Gardner years.
Here came the young John Elliott Gardner, who was making a name for himself in period performance practice. and it wasn't too long until the string players were all using their Baroque bows, and we were playing Bach and Handel in a way that none of us had ever played it before.
He had an energy level that it just was astonishing. I mean, the guy was just always on the move. And he takes music off a page like no other conductor. He just brings it alive with a kind of rhythmic energy that when it gets going, it's so exciting.
Was sort of on the forefront, and like I remember playing some Mozart symphonies with him with adagio tempi that were literally twice as fast as I would have played them with conductors from an earlier generation, and going, wow, now that I think he's on to something here, because the music sounds so fresh and it doesn't get bogged down, and the slow movements especially have a line that you can capture. I remember him explaining that, well, the instruments of the time, you know, they couldn't sustain a line at these unbelievably slow tempi that we're accustomed to playing now. And it really opened a lot of musical doors, I think.
The other thing, of course, was that we had this mandate now to do early music. And to that end, the string players, of course, would use gut strings and play a semitone lower than is usual, and also use Baroque bows, which is the quickest way to get a Baroque string sound. And we were all rather enthusiastic about this because, as Roger said, it was a sort of new insight into music. And one of our colleagues, Angela, said, you know, we've all become born-again Baroque violinists. but I remember the very first concert we did, which was spent more tuning up than anything else, and I felt pretty good about it. And after the next day, we had a session back in the studio, and John Elliott came up to me and said, do you mind if I say something? And I said, no. I thought he was going to say, well, you know, I thought you played very well. Of course, he didn't. He said, you used vibrato. Oh.
The incredible Gardner years of the CBC Radio Orchestra. John Elliott Gardner left in 1983, and that's when Mario Bernardi took over, and he's remained ever since. Here again are Roger Cole, Karen Wilson, and Ian Hampton.
Well, Mario Bernardi, when I first worked with him, he was very intimidating because he had a huge reputation, and he has fantastic ears, and he hears everything. from, you know, sloppy entrances to wrong notes to intonation. So you have the sense that it doesn't matter what instrument you're playing, but very few things go past him. So I found him a bit intimidating in my early years, especially at the CBC when there were time constraints and it's, you know, pretty high pressure, some of those sessions. But I found he really, one of his biggest gifts was managing the time, because I don't ever remember running out of time when Mario was doing a program.
We had some close calls.
Did we have some close calls?
Oh, we had the occasional close call.
Well, of course, Mario was an excellent pianist and really gifted at playing orchestral scores on the piano, which I just don't hear very many conductors that can do that anymore. And I remember I was doing a solo piece, I can't recall. I think it was an Australian piece. Anyway, it was sort of a new piece, and I was playing, and he wanted to have a session, you know, to discuss what we were going to do with the piece. And he just sight-read the score with me playing the oboe part. It just blew me away that he can just sit down and play almost anything on the piano.
He's a wonderful musician, and I think what I developed over the time I worked with him was an understanding that what he really wants to do is realize what the composer has written. It's not that he's trying to put his own interpretation on things, although that's part of it, but what he feels, I believe, is an obligation to the score to make the music exactly what the composer had hoped it would be.
Also, when we make recordings these days, recordings have become a great deal easier with digital recording, but the way it's done is that if you have a couple of days of recording, you would make a template. You'd lay down a track of a movement, and then you would record again, and then if there was anything else that needed patching from those two performances, you would fix it. Sometimes there were things which were not quite fixed, and at the end of the second day, when you'd forgotten all about what happened on day one, the producer would say, look, we need letter A in the first movement of Concerto so-and-so, and you've got like 30 seconds to leap to it before the end of the session. And Mario seemed always to be able to find the right tempo so it's going to fit with what happened yesterday.
Well, he's a superb conductor when it comes to Mozart and Haydn, because as Karen said, he doesn't put himself between the players and the music. He just, it's very honest music making and very direct.
Those were the voices of Roger Cole, Karen Wilson, and Ian Hampton talking about Mario Bernardi's tenure with the CBC Radio Orchestra. The Radio Orchestra celebrates 65 years this season, and Mario celebrates 20 years, and his relationship is ongoing. Congratulations to Mario and all the players who have given us such great music over 65 years. Thanks also to producer Kathleen Flaherty for the remembrances, and thanks again to Denise Ball, who is the manager of the CBC Radio Orchestra, and recording engineer Don Harder. Also thanks to Keith Hart at CBC Radio Archives. And that's On Stage for this Sunday. Questions, comments, suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. You can send them to us by email, onstage@cbc.ca, or write to us at On Stage, CBC Radio Music, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. And do check out our website. We invite you to do that. It's at cbc.ca/onstage, cbc.ca/onstage. On Stage is produced by Mark Steinmetz. I'm Eric Friesen. Thanks for being with us. It's always good to know that you're out there listening.